It's Friday, November 7th, 2014, and you're listening to We the People, Constitution Matters. Good morning to everybody, and welcome to We the People, Constitution Matters. I'm Bruce Stocking, and usually my co-host Corinne Lillis is here, but she's off to here, and I'm joined by my co-host for It's a New Day, Andrew Turner. Welcome to the show, Andrew.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Andrew will be pushing the buttons and pulling the levers and doing all that other fun stuff that we need to get the show going. And today we're going to be talking the issue of... well, the presidency in the Constitution, and we'll be joined in this hour by, of course, Gary Porter, Executive Director of the Constitution Leadership Initiative, and we're hoping to hear from Charles Proctor of the law firm of Proctor & Lindsay in this first half of the program. Chuck will be calling in as well, but Gary's with us right now, and so good morning, Gary.
Good morning, Bruce. How are you? Everything up in the King of Prussia?
It is a clear day, but it is kind of cold out there. So I think we've gone right from fall. We're starting to jump right into winter right now. So, you know, it's a typical scenario.
Okay.
So I take it things are a little bit warmer down there in Yorktown.
Slightly warmer, but we had a great big rain last night, so everything's really soggy.
Oh, yeah, yeah, we had that, and that's what brought on the cool weather. So, you know, 'tis the season, as they say.
Got to stay flexible.
Yes, indeed. Well, Gary, let's kind of get the ball rolling. I'm hoping to be joined by, Chuck. We're looking for him to be calling in. And also in our second half of the program, we're going to have David Whitney on as well. Right. So our panel's going to be here. It's just not, they're not in the studio today. So
as I like to call it, it's the easiest hour in radio for someone like me.
Oh, is.
You know, you're the referee. I wind up and I let it go. And then, you know, it doesn't stop for a whole hour. So.
It's like Chuck Proctor said, this is the fastest hour in radio as well.
True.
So why don't we get this hour going? Gary, we're talking about the presidency and the Constitution. Your essay, which I love the title, We Want a King?
Right. Right. Well, you know, the impetus for this column was seeing a news report of a fundraising event that Gwyneth Paltrow hosted out in her Beverly Hills mansion for Barack Obama. And the amazing statement that she made and was quoted at, it would be wonderful if we are able to give, speaking of the president, all the power he needs to accomplish the things he needs to do. And that was such an amazing statement, and it's so revealing that the lack of knowledge of the Constitution, how it's supposed to work, particularly Article 2 governing the executive, is just so pervasive that I thought that had to be the focus. So what she's basically asking for is, we want a king. We want a king so that we don't have to worry about all the messy details involved in self-government. We just give this guy all the power he wants, let him go, trusting he's going to do the right thing, and we can go back to Dancing with the Stars or watching Iron Man DVDs.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, this is something that I got out of your article reading it, and it hit so clear. You know, especially the one line you have in the first paragraph there where Daddy, take care of me. And,
right.
You know, that certainly is not what our founders and envisioned whatsoever. The government is there to take care of them. The government is there to protect them, yes. But it's up to ourselves to do it. So it comes down to responsibility. And we have come down to the point, of course, with this, the anointed one, which is in the Oval Office right now, which is, I know better than you, and I will take care of you, so you don't have to do anything and have the responsibility for that. Fundamentally wrong.
Well, and I point out that we're not treading on unfurled ground here. Others have tried this and not been successful. And I point to the example of biblical Israel, where they asked for a king, and that's where I got my title, of course, from 1 Samuel 8:3. But they asked for a king because they weren't willing to put in the effort to govern themselves, and they got a king, but it didn't work out well for them.
Yeah.
And even after Samuel pointed out all the various ways that having a king was going to be to their detriment. And if you don't mind, I'd like to take just a minute here to read this out of 1 Samuel.
Sure, please.
He says, this is what a king who will reign over you will claim as his rights. He will take your sons and make them serve with his chariots and horses, and they will run in front of his chariots. That sounds like a draft, a military draft to me. some he will assign to be commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, and others to plow his ground and reap his harvest, and still others to make weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive groves and give them to his attendants. He will take a tenth of your grain and of your vintage and give it to his officials and attendants. Sounds like wealth redistribution.
Oh, yes.
Your male and female servants and the best of your cattle, the donkeys he will take for his own use. He will take a tenth of your flocks, and you yourselves will become his slaves. When that day comes, you will cry out for relief from the king you have chosen, but the Lord will not answer you in that day. So, you know, how prescient was that passage to the way we see the overpowering executive working in many nations, not just in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Well, true, and you know, with overpowering executive in the United States, I could think of nobody else better to weigh in on this one than Chuck Proctor. He's on the line with us. Chuck, are you there?
Good morning, Bruce. And now, you know, I didn't get your attachment yesterday in the email. And now I know why Gary wanted to appoint me as king. It makes perfect sense.
I was going to respond to that and say perhaps emperor.
Or emperor. Either one works for me. That would be just fine. But I hear what Gary's saying, and there are other passages in Scripture that refer to this same syndrome that we're in right now. And I call it a syndrome because when you look at some of the political comments that have been made after the election, and you look at the, first of all, the denial that mm-hmm. this was a, you know, they used the word wave. What happened to the word landslide? What happened to the word, I mean, some people have used mandate, but we've seen a whole different approach to this, even from the conservative media, because I don't think they want to offend anybody. I think they want to continue to keep their ratings up by using words that don't hurt people's feelings.
Oh, yeah,
and this
exactly.
is, we have to start getting the word out. And what Gary just said a moment ago, and that scripture he quoted, is something that should be used in an election campaign, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, you know, it kind of falls into the ridiculousness with the wordsmithing that goes on for whatever unknown reason. I'm sure there's a known reason. But, you know, when you look at a store, all of a sudden there for a while it was a brick-and-mortar store. And I guess they figured out how ridiculous that sounds, and they just went back to a person's store. But, you know, and it's easy to the fact, Gary, that what you're writing about here, one tends to look at water. Water takes the least path of resistance to get to wherever it's going. People are very similar to that. Hey, if I can elect somebody that's going to take care of all this, I don't have to worry about that type of thing and take care of him. He'll take care of me.
Well, there's another metaphor that speaks well to this, and that is that nature abhors a vacuum.
Yes.
And when people do not exercise self-government, when they do not engage with their government, that vacuum that they create by their absence is going to be filled by something or someone. So when we don't engage with our representatives and we don't push them in the direction that we, the people, want them to go, Well, the government's very willing to fill that void and operate on its own volition.
Yes, they are. And if I could jump in real quick with a little housekeeping here, is that let folks know that you're listening to We the People, Constitution Matters, right here on 1180 AM WFYL, and the program's brought to you by ShopRite and Valley Forge PC Repair. So get a little housekeeping in there as we go. But you're exactly right. The American people have allowed such things as Barack Obama, now the current president, to come in there and begin. You know, you wrote about and we discussed legislating from the bench, but you also discuss in your essay that we now have a president which is legislating from the Oval Office. And last of my recollection, that's the job of Congress.
Hmm. Well, it is, but he is quite willing to go. And there's another example of how a vacuum gets filled. You know, and when Congress doesn't act, and oftentimes for good reasons, but when they don't act, then the president feels like he has the duty to step in and do what they would not do.
Mm-hmm.
One example is cap and trade. Congress could not come up with the votes to pass cap and trade, but the president, through his EPA, is enacting many of the provisions of cap and trade on his own volition. Well, that's legislating when Congress refused to do so, and they had good reason to not legislate in that particular area.
Mm-hmm.
Another example is the DREAM Act.
Yes.
Congress failed, and Congress would not pass the DREAM Act. Well, so the president is taking it then as his job to enact provisions of the DREAM Act, and he's even threatened to do that after the election. We'll see if he carries that through. But, you know, at some point, the people need to say, wait a minute. We have a constitution, and it defines specific powers for the president, and you have exceeded them carte blanche.
Mm-hmm.
You have exceeded them regularly. So we need to take some steps here to put the executive back in the constitutional box that it should be operating in.
Exactly so. And Chuck, with this on the legal aspect of, well, we've heard so much with this president going around Congress using his magic pen and his phone with overreaching authority with, quote, executive orders. And for me, at least, I see that through this whole equation and what's coming out, the first three words of the Constitution, we the people, seem to be left out of the mix. And what Gary's talking about, that the Congress did not act, and I know in a perfect world you'll look at and say, well, Congress will act because they represent the people themselves, so the people didn't want, so Congress didn't act. But what's the legal aspect here?
Well, Bruce, in addition, you have another component here, and that's the judiciary branch, which has been legislating from the bench for years and creating some of the issues and problems we have, and they want to get in on the act, too. They want to be part of the legislators. And the most recent example, which I think I brought up a few weeks ago, is the final order in the Hobby Lobby Conestoga Woods case, where the judge put a footnote in the order where they granted the permanent injunction after 4 months after the decision by the Supreme Court, which is a story in itself, and then puts this footnote that says, in an overabundance of caution, the government reserves the right to enforce any further accommodation or legislation that may be enacted regarding this matter.
Mm-hmm.
Now, first of all, you don't prospectively, looking forward from the bench, rule on something that hasn't even been brought before you. I mean, it's just unheard of. Secondly, they could not leave it alone. There's just this mentality that whether I'm a judge, whether I'm in the executive office, I'm going to assert my influence, my power, my ideology on the people. And this is just not what the Constitution provides for. And it's just unheard of. In fact, I was so appalled at that footnote, which, of course, in a sense, doesn't mean anything, that I had considered going back to Third Circuit to get it removed. But we decided that that was not the best use of our time and effort. Just like a lot of people saying, oh, impeach Obama, but that's just going to lead into the whole concept of giving more attention to him and putting and taking attention away from the issues. So you've got all three branches vying for power, vying for the ability to put forth what they believe in, and they're not following what our founders set up in the Constitution in a system that worked very, very well for many years. Yes, there were debates. It wasn't easy. There are many times, if you look at history, and Gary could probably give us a half dozen right off the top of his head, where Congress and the President and the judiciary have had fallings out, to say the least. But this is unprecedented, what we're going through right now, and I hope that this election makes a difference. I hope that the people that have been elected this time will take the opportunity to make that difference for all of us.
And Chuck, you do bring up a good point there. In fact, while you were talking as well and thinking of what you were relating, there's actually a quote from old Chuckie Schumer of New York. And, you know, we know Chuck Schumer. He's a man that any camera lends his face wants to be in front of it. And he's claiming that there are three branches of government, the House, the Senate, and the President.
Yes, I've heard that quote before, and somehow he forgets about the judiciary. And frankly, if you want to, from my perspective as an attorney, your most important office is the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court, because they're the ones that are going to determine what any of them, of the other two branches, can do. They control themselves, and the people that are elected, the people that are appointed to that position should be very, very carefully selected and thought out and vetted, as they say, by the Senate when the President appoints them. So we're sure that we have people who, what's that word? Well, defend and uphold the Constitution of the United States. And we're not seeing that happen.
Right. Now, I know from my perspective, just to jump in a little bit, when I just growing up, what we were always taught, well, you know, from the top down, there was the President, and then there were the, you know, the congressmen and senators and everything like that, and then there were the foot soldiers, you know, the courts and the lawyers and all the judges and all those systems of government. And, you know, they always told us, you know, the separation of powers and everything like that. One branch should not have too much power.
Well, but that also reveals a lack of understanding of how the founders set up this thing in the beginning.
Yeah.
They thought that the legislative branch would predominate. James Madison made several statements to that effect, and they saw the Congress as being the center of gravity for the government. Hmm. Well, that has shifted over the years, and now we see the presidency as the center of gravity of the government. We give him titles like leader of the free world, which doesn't help the problem at all.
Well, and Gary, you know, I think that comes by, that's like an inherent title. Because if you take a look in the 20th century, that the world looked at America. You know, what is America going to do? It took America in World War I to actually break it and bring it to an end. It took America in World War II to land on the beaches of Normandy and force the end to come up. So I think that's a moniker, I think, that's well-deserved, because I always say if America leads, the world will follow. And this is a problem that we have, is we have no leadership, and so the world is, as they said, going to hell in a handbag.
Well, yes, but it's America, and as you rightly point out, it's America. It is not the President. America has this reputation as being a leader, but we focus all that leadership on one man,
right.
and really that's incorrect.
I don't know. Is it? I'll play devil's advocate with you. Is it because the President of the United States is our chief person in the world that represents us, we the people, in the country, and so to look upon that person in that role, I don't know. In my mind, that's the way I can see it. Gentlemen, what do you think? Go ahead, Gary, you first.
Oh, yeah. Well, there are two primary roles of the chief executive. One is to be commander-in-chief, and we all grant that. The Constitution makes that crystal clear, that he used to be the commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy, and the other military forces as well. And the other primary responsibility he has is to see that the laws are effectively executed.
Mm-hmm.
That's really what the office devolves around.
That's what in other words, that's what the position description states is his job.
Exactly. See that the laws are, I'm trying to come up with the exact wording here.
Executed?
executed, but the way the Article 2 frames it. But anyway, that's basically what his office should be focused on. And yet, so let's go back to the commander-in-chief responsibility. Yes, that's an important responsibility. And it not only involves the use of American forces overseas, but also to protect the homeland from sudden attack. So it's an immense responsibility. That no one doubts that. But I'm not sure that it needs to be couched in terms like leader of the free world.
Mm-hmm.
The Constitution doesn't say anything about being leader of the free world.
You're correct. Chuck, your thoughts on this?
Well, I agree with Gary completely that the president's role has gone far beyond what our founding fathers thought it would be. They needed a commander-in-chief. They needed someone to be the head of state and to give a State of the Union address to Congress every year. They put that right in the Constitution. But his primary purpose was for domestic tranquility and to protect the citizens from not only outside influences, but inside influences, and to be a kind of a cohesive force. What we're seeing right now is nothing but a divisive force in many aspects. Just about every time he gets up to the microphone, he throws in something that, you know, he started out on Wednesday in his press conference with an olive branch. Oh, I'm going to have everybody over and meet with them. But if you don't do this in the next six or seven weeks, I'm going to use my pen and my phone, and I'm going to do it anyway. And he just doesn't understand the concept of conciliation or working with people. And granted, these issues are difficult. Granted, we need a lot of discernment to put them together properly. But we need a leader. And I don't want to get into the, we need Ronald Reagan again. Ronald Reagan was a great man, believe me. But we need a leader today who can take this country and solve some of these complex problems, not someone who's out there with his own agenda and his own aggrandizement. And it says nothing in the Constitution. Gary, correct me if I'm wrong, but it says nothing in the Constitution about the president shall initiate legislation. The president shall
recommend
doing any of the things that he's doing right now.
Yeah,
right.
Gary, go ahead.
The Article 2 gives the president the responsibility to recommend from time to time measures that he seems prudent, but not to write legislation necessarily, and certainly not to enact it on his own volition.
Right. Well, gentlemen, we're going to have a break coming up on us here. You're listening to We the People Constitution Matters. We're talking to Gary Porter, Executive Director of the Constitution Leadership Initiative, and Chuck Proctor of the law firm of Proctor and Lindsay. And we're talking the role of the presidency and the current role, what the president is or is not doing, but what the Constitution states is the job. We're going to take a quick break. On the other side of the break, we'll come back with our discussion. And later on in the program, we're going to be joined by David Whitney, who's the pastor of the and senior instructor of the Institute of the Constitution. Stay with us. It's We the People, Constitution Matters, right here on 1180 AM WFYL. And we're back after a short news break. And we are listening to We the People, Constitution Matters, right here on 1180 AM WFYL. Today's topic, of course, is the presidency and the Constitution. What the Constitution of the United States, which literally comes out to be a position description for the President of the United States, what his role and function and job is. And we're also discussing how it's gotten to where it is today, what is being done, if anything is being done with that office, and is it being done legally, justifiably, and is it being done for we, the people itself. We're talking with Gary Porter, our contributors to the program, and Gary's the director of the Constitution Leadership Initiative. We've also been talking to Charles Proctor, law firm of Proctor and Lindsay, another gentleman, our staples on this program, And so, gentlemen, let's continue our conversation on this. And, of course, I want to mention that Corinne Lillis, my co-host, is not – she's off today, so I have Andrew Turner on
We hope
board.
She's on a beach somewhere.
Yeah,
you know.
She's probably someplace warm knowing her. But I want to get things going with Andrew, with what we've talked about so far, maybe some of your thoughts.
Well, I think that, you know, I didn't know so much went into the presidency, first off. You know, there's all of these topics that Gary and Chuck both brought up that were very, very, it seems like it's more of a hotly contested item than most people think.
Yeah, there's a lot to it. And Gary, you can jump in on this. There's a lot to the presidency that over the years has, you know, we talked about, and you know, the leader of the free world, which he's not. And things such as that that have just been kind of piled on, you know, in the old government realm of employment, you had your position description, then they had that little caveat in the bottom that says other duties as assigned.
Well, I point out in my essay that this problem of legislating from the Oval Office is nothing new to Barack Obama. Presidents all up and down our history have been doing the same thing, so he has plenty of precedent for this. And I point out Teddy Roosevelt was one who took this very much to heart. One example, there was a treaty that the Senate, that Roosevelt had negotiated with country, and the Senate had failed to ratify it. Well, not to be outdone, not to be stymied, Roosevelt just took that treaty and renamed it an executive agreement and implemented it by executive order. So, you know, when you see that your predecessor's doing that, when someone like Barack Obama comes into office, you know, he says, well, you know, I'm not breaking new ground here. This has been done before. No reason why I can't do it as well.
Right. And, you know, I think a lot of folks need to realize that we hear so much with the magic pen and the phone and the executive orders and think the president, by a sweep of his pen, can dictate to the American people, when in essence, if you're going to look at it as a, let's look at it as a corporation, he's the CEO of the corporation, so if he sends a memo down on something, it only goes to those departments and agencies and employees under his direct control. After all, he is under our direct control. I know everybody's chuckling at that one. But I want to bring into the conversation here David Whitney, pastor and senior instructor of the Institute on the Constitution. Good morning, David. It's good to talk to you.
Good morning. Thank you so much. And, you know, when we talk about areas where we have expanded the power way beyond what the constitutional limits are of the executive branch, one of the ones that is commonly assumed is that he is automatically the chief of the powers of the military. And that needs to have a huge caveat put into that. When we understand the balance of power between the legislative branch and the executive branch, he is only the chief of the military when they are called into service.
Mm-hmm.
Our founders' design was never to have a standing army. They abhorred a standing army. They had suffered under the British standing army that had pillaged their homes and killed citizens and so on. They knew a standing army was extremely dangerous, so they built into our Constitution a structure by which there would be no standing army at the beck and call of the president. Instead, it was the state militias under the rulership of each governor of the state. In fact, all the officers appointed in the militia were appointed at the state level, with the exception of the general officers. So only at the national level would general officers be appointed. So until there was a declaration of war by Congress, there would be no military other than the Navy. Yes, the Navy was an ongoing military branch that did not have a declaration of war to continue in existence. But the Army and any other branch that related to the Army, which, you know, like the Air Force ultimately came out of the Army and that sort of thing, those things were not automatically in play under the executive branch. Only when there was a declaration of war were the militias of the several states then called to service and under the command of the president. But if there's no declaration of war, that standing army would have to be disbanded. In fact, the last time we had a constitutional declaration of war was World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting to see what happened after World War II. What should have taken place is all the troops and all the army dismantled, gone back to the state militias, but it did not. We began to have a standing army from that point forward that has, again, been used by the president to be put into all kinds of action, you know, whether it was an invasion of Grenada or whether it was what took place in Kosovo and on the list of things go, completely illegally and completely unconstitutionally.
Right.
And
David,
when you mention this...
You bring up a very good point there because, you know, historically with myself, thinking back, you look at the realm of the American Civil War, 1861 to 1865, is that the standing army of the United States was very, very small. And that even on both sides, it was the militia, it was the state militia that offered their service to the federal government at the time. And, of course, in the South to the Southern government in the time of crisis. And after that, they were returned back to the states to be mustered out. And if... In a sense, and it was an all-volunteer army. In a sense, you look at it today, and we're back to that all-volunteer army thing. But the fact with, as you rightfully claim, that the last declaration of war was World War II, and politically we played the game with Korea, calling it a police action, Vietnam, very similar to that.
That idea of conflict rather than a war.
Exactly.
Conflict.
Well, you even take a look at, we had a department, the War Department,
right.
And it was changed to Department of Defense to make it softer and gentler.
Right.
But, so you've got those type of things in there, but you take a look now. At, we have the War Powers Act, and with the War Powers Act allows limited authority to the president to act in a time of crisis, and I think the key word there is limited authority. And what he's currently been talking about with the situation with ISIS, oh, it's going to be a long-term thing. Your thoughts?
Again, and when you unleash the restrictions that are placed upon the chief executive here, you have a very dangerous situation. It's a situation that we as Americans ought to be concerned about because our founders knew that ultimately if you allow a standing army to exist, some tyrant is going to come along and he's going to use that standing army for his tyrannical purposes. They saw it with the British, and we see kind of, I believe, the leading edge of that here in America because up until recently, the doctrine was that the police powers of the state could never be utilizing the military powers. In other words, you cannot use the troops on the ground unless they're under the direct authority of the local sheriff, in an emergency situation, you know, the National Guard, that kind of thing. Well, that's been changed. That doctrine has been rejected. That it has been standing for more than 100 years because after the war the war between the states, the doctrine was clearly established. We're not going to allow the military to be used in police actions right. on the ground here in America. Today, that has been rejected, and they are specifically training troops to do police actions and to quell crowd control and other things like that. That's extremely dangerous.
Right. Well, it's just, you know,
not the tool to do that with.
It's an extension of the, you know, the government to use every bit of the military towards its own citizens and. And you're right, it's a slippery slope. But David, you also brought up another good point previously. I wasn't able to jump in on, and that was when you were talking about how the states appoint the militia and everything like that. And I just wanted to remind everybody that that's wholly ceremonial now. When you hear about, you know, oh, I'm going to appoint you as a part of the state militia, it really seems more of a ceremonial kind of nod more than something that actually matters.
Well, and also you can look at, and Gary, I want your angle on this as well, is that each state has its own National Guard, which is hearkening back to the militia, hearkening back to the old days, the beginning of the Revolutionary War with the Minutemen, and under the control of the state. And now we have a situation, let's take a look at Texas, where Rick Perry wanted to call out the National Guard to be on the border down there. And the president is going crazy on this thing. He doesn't have the authority, and they want to make life rough on this. How did we get to that?
Well, for one thing, we got there by a transmogrification, if that's the right word.
Glad you said that, not me.
of what a militia is. Now, under the original founding understanding of a militia, it was every able-bodied man, and in some cases women, between certain ages. And that there is legislation in many states today that, that still contains that, that reference. In Virginia, you are a member of the militia. It's called the unorganized militia, but you're a member of the militia if you're between 16 and 55 years old.
Ah.
A man or a woman. And so the militia exists still in some states today in its original concept, but then we the American people have kind of supplanted the idea of a militia with the National Guard, which is not correct. The National Guard is not the militia. So I think Governor Perry is quite correct in his use of his National Guard, or even to call up his militia to help secure the border that the federal government has decided not to secure.
Yeah. Well, of course, gentlemen, on this topic right here, with what we've talked about so far, is that here we have a president that's far exceeded his position description laid out in the Constitution of the United States. The American people, the Congress, has allowed it to take place and just build and metastasize to the point now where we have a president think by the stroke of the pen he can just kind of do whatever he wants to do and then go on the golf course. So how do we get there? How does it come back, and can it come back? David, I'll give you the first word on that one.
Well, the Congress, that is our House of Representatives, is supposed to impeach him whenever he violates his oath of office. And he's violated his oath of office in so many ways for so many years. There's a long list of impeachable offenses. They are to draw up a list of those offenses, and then the Senate is to hold a trial. And on, in that trial, they're to determine guilt or innocence for each of those charges of impeachment that the House of Representatives has drawn up. We cannot seem to find anyone with guts enough in the House to begin the impeachment process. So on the federal level, that's what's to happen. Mm-hmm. The states, however, should resist every usurpation. That's what Washington told us. Every usurpation on the part of the federal government, they should say that's not law. We will not allow that to happen. You know, the National Guard belongs to the state of Texas, not to the federal government, because there's no declaration of war. Therefore, the National Guard is grabbed by the state of Texas and no longer under the power of the federal government. So there should be resistance at the state level, impeachment at the federal level.
Yeah. Good points on that one. David, I know you've got to run. I'd like to
thank you so much.
Thank you for calling in with your comments. Like to hear more from you as the shows go on in that. But have a great day, and thanks again, my friend.
God bless.
Thank you, David.
Okay, Gary?
I'm glad David brought up Washington, because Washington faced a really difficult problem. He was the first executive, the first chief executive, and there was no blueprint. There was only the Constitution. So he had to figure out, you know, where are the limits and how do I really operate within the Constitution's guidelines?
Mm-hmm.
And he rightfully pointed out that the states have great powers, great sovereignty remaining. They did not give up all their sovereignty to the federal government or the national government. And so the states need to exercise that power. And some of them are starting to realize that they do have this power and they're starting to push back, which is good. But Washington really was having to make it up as he went. And he made a few mistakes of his own. For instance, there was a war going on between France and England, as there always seemed to be.
Right.
And he wanted the America to stay out of that and stay neutral and not get committed. So he issued an executive order that prohibited Americans from aiding either side.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's really not within his guidelines either.
Right.
But They do what they can, and when they exceed their proper powers, then the American people need to say, step back, take a deep breath, and listen to the Constitution.
Well, yeah, exactly, and it's you take a look at, I think, the first president that we had that actively got involved in something in the world was, of course, Thomas Jefferson in the Barbary Coast Wars. However, with Washington, is that you look at this man himself, is that here he is at the end of the Revolutionary War, as the English said, this man could have had everything. He shows up at Congress meeting in Annapolis, and he returns his commission, basically turns in his sword, saying, job done, I'm going home to do what I want to do. And then when he becomes president, and you're exactly right, there's no blueprint. There's nothing here. It's the old thing. We're going to kind of make this up as we go along. But there was character. There was responsibility, morality, all those virtuous qualities that he basically wrote the book on being a president on this, and how quickly we've lost that.
Right. All presidents would benefit from a study of how Washington approached the job and the character that he brought into that job. I point out in my essay that if anybody could have been king, it was Washington, coming off of the Revolutionary War on such a wave of popularity. He had control of an army, and he had the hearts and minds of most of his citizens. If anybody was in a better position to become king, I can't think of one. And yet he turned down the job, basically. I hope we're going to have a chance here soon to hear why Washington did that.
Yeah, and Gary, you know what? We've got the man himself on the line right now.
No, you don't say.
Certainly
has come back.
Certainly
come
not.
Back.
Well, it's been so bad in the country, I guess he's been resurrected to come back to bring morality and virtue back to the country again.
George, by some magic, are you on our phone lines right now?
I am, sir. Thank you.
I wonder if you could shed a little bit of light on your presidency for us and our listeners.
Well, first of all, it was a great honor to be elected to serve the people in this way. But you said something a moment ago about resurrection, and there's some words over where I rest each night at Mount Vernon that says, "Whosoever liveth and believeth in me shall never die, and thus I'm with you this morning."
Well, Mr. Washington, let me ask you this. With the current situation, if you have been listening, and akin to what we've been talking about here, how the office in which you designed the blueprint for, and basically the job description and how it has been morphed, let's use that word, into what it is today, your thoughts on this, your feelings.
Well, there's a number of things. I have been listening to your entire program, and one of the things that's, I think, a very common misconception that is not difficult to come to is that we say that we have three branches of government. Well, that's what's in the basic Constitution, but in the Bill of Rights, Article 5, the Fifth Amendment, gives a fourth branch of government, and that's the grand jury. It was a pre-constitutional branch that was grafted back onto the structure. And if you'll remember, the grand jury was the instrument of government that brought accountability for abuse of the presidency by Mr. Nixon some years ago. It was not the Senate. It was not the House. It was the grand jury. And the U.S. Supreme Court said that the executive privilege did not apply to the grand jury, but it did apply to Congress and it did apply to the judiciary. So we, the people, as citizens, still have our duties to hold our public servants, elected and appointed, accountable through the agency of the grand jury.
Well, sir, let me ask you one final question. With the Constitution, with the presidency, of course, you sat as the president of the Constitutional Convention, which was originally just, of course, to tweak the Articles of Confederation. And your thoughts on coming out of that, about the document, about the work, the labors that you and the convention put into it to create something never seen on the earth before in this whole world, and your thoughts on direction. I'll give you the final thought on that one.
Well, indeed, the Constitutional Convention has been described as the miracle in Philadelphia, and miracles are gifts of God. And that this Constitution for the United States of America is indeed a gift of God. But God works through those who work with him under his guidance. And that's what we did. Essentially, the Constitution, I was like the professor of government, and my brilliant graduate student was James Madison, and our research librarian was Thomas Jefferson, sending us things from Europe. So we studied the various constitutions of the confederacies in Europe to be able to take the best of what we knew to create a new document for the ages, and that's this Constitution. Mm-hmm. And there are aspects of this Constitution that are really tremendous, and we're losing those things now because we're not familiar with the intricacies of the plan and the structure of this Constitution. And so, I mean, like one thing, for example, we talk about the electors electing the president. Well, there was Plan H as well. That's Plan E for electing the president. Plan H is that if there's a question about the integrity of the electoral system, then we can have the other people elected at the same election, the House of Representatives member, to elect the president.
Yeah.
And, of course, that was done in 1800 with Mr. Jefferson and done in 1824 with Mr. John Quincy Adams. And so there are aspects of this Constitution. And, by the way, it should have been done in the election of 2012 because of the many indications, including in Pennsylvania, of voting irregularities due to electronic voting.
Yeah. Well, sir, I'd like to thank you for your contribution to the program. You've added a lot to the discussion at this time. Again, thank you very much. God bless you and for your service.
Gary, before you go, I have a question for the general, and that is, why did you not take a kingship that was apparently available in 1783?
Well, there's a lot of people say it's because of Cato or Cincinnatus, but I suggest to you, I am a student of the Bible, and remember they tried to make Jesus an earthly king, and he departed from them and went into the mountains. Well, they tried to make me an earthly king, and I departed from them at the Annapolis. I resigned my commission as general and commander-in-chief and went to Mount Vernon to celebrate the birth of Jesus Christ for the first time in 8 years at my home at Mount Vernon. So I was following Jesus Christ, and in my prayers as a young man, I said, daily forge me more and more into the likeness of thy son, Jesus Christ. If you do that, you can't go wrong as a president.
All right.
Very good. Well said.
Thank you very much, George. You know, we do have a few minutes left here, yes. Bruce, so why don't we finish things up now?
Yes, I do want to point out that our George Washington was James Menship. He is a historian who represents General Washington and many different things. I'd like to thank him for his contribution and his historic background that he brought to the program. Gary, I'm going to give you, we only got a minute or two left, I'm going to give you the final thoughts.
Well, the final thought here is that it all comes back to the we the people, and it sounds repetitious, but that's really where this issue needs to lie. Bill Federer brought out an essay just this week, which was very serendipitous, and he points out that a king, another name for a king, is a sovereign. And a sovereign connotes the existence of a power center. Well, in the United States, the sovereign really is the people. The people are the sovereign power, and we have forgotten that. We have forgotten that all the powers that our government has originated with us, we the people. And when those powers are ever used improperly or irregularly, they need to be brought back to the people until we get things sorted out.
Yes.
Certainly. Yeah.
And after all, you know, this falls into the fact that, you know, and we've talked about this before many times, you know, this whole thing referring to the United States as a democracy. No, we're a republic, a representative government. Mm. And how quickly we lose sight because of the pretty word of democracy, which seems to carry better in the media than republic.
Gary, I can't tell you how angry Bruce gets when we have people that say, I love this democracy we live in. And he just, I'll get you for this one.
Yeah. So, I think there's a lot here to continue with the presidency. Usually when we get on these hot topics, we'll take two programs to do it. And I think, what do you think next week, following up and continuing on this topic?
Well, we can, and I was glad that the good general brought up the issue of electors.
Yes.
Because there's an initiative in this country to do away with electoral college and the whole concept of electors that the founders put in place. And I think I'd kind of like to talk about that a little bit next week.
That is perfect. In fact, that's a hot topic issue, which I brought up on a number of occasions on our New Day program as well. So let's set our chart on our course,
yes,
as we sail through the Constitution, the deal with the electoral college process in the country and the founding of it that meant, and things along those lines. So
Gary, the general was quite timeless, wasn't he? He's been keeping
yes.
up.
Yes.
You're keeping up to date on many of the today's events.
There's a thrill going up my leg right now.
Funny you don't sound like Chris Matthews.
Well, from all of us here at WFYL, I'd like to thank, Gary Porter, as well as Charles Proctor, David Whitney, and the good general himself.
Yes, it was James Manship who represented the general. And so, good program all. We've been many different places on the phone today because our contributors are all over the place, but we'll bring them all back in and put them hard to work here next Friday on We the People Constitution Matters. It is Friday, November 7th. That means the weekend's at hand. Get out there and do something, and especially do it with your family.
That's
See
right.
you next week.